You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. This past Monday, the world learned of the passing of a true comedy legend when it was announced that Carl Reiner died at the ripe old age of 98. For any young people listening, let me tell you a little about him. Carl Reiner first attracted national attention way back in 1950 as Sid Caesar's multi-talented second banana on the television variety show Your Show of Shows, for which he also was a writer. A decade later, he created The Dick Van Dyke Show, one of the most celebrated sitcoms in television history, and teamed with Mel Brooks on the hugely successful 2,000-Year-Old Man Records. His novel, Enter Laughing, became both a hit Broadway play and the first of many movies he would direct. Those movies included Where's Papa?, Oh God, starring George Burns, and four of Steve Martin's best and earliest films, including The Jerk and All of Me. Carl Reiner was the third person to receive the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for Humor, and he also won praise and awards as an actor as well, with memorable roles in films like The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, and more recently, Ocean's 11 and its sequels. But aside from his accomplishments on screen, he was also simply one of the loveliest human beings on earth. I got to know Carl over the years and had him on the show a couple of times, as well as his son, Rob Reiner. I spent time with him at his home in Beverly Hills, sitting in the same chairs where he and his best friend Mel Brooks had dinner and watched old movies almost every night. I listened to him regale me with stories from the golden age of television, tell me the most hilarious jokes, and carry on about the politics of the day, especially Donald Trump. Well into his mid-90s, he delighted in showing off how he could still climb stairs without assistance, and he led me around his office, where he continued to write books and tweet to the very end. I last saw Carl when he was 95, and even then, he was really just a big kid in an old man's body. Carl Reiner was a shining example of a life well lived, and lived with passion long past the age when most people hang it up and stop trying. In the words of his buddy Mel Brooks, Carl was a giant, unmatched in his contributions to entertainment. I met him in 1950 when he joined Sid Caesar on Your Show of Shows, and we've been best friends ever since. I loved him. When we were doing the 2,000-Year-Old Man together, there was no better straight man in the world. So whether he wrote or performed, or he was just your best friend, nobody could do it better. He'll be greatly missed. A tired cliche in times like this, but in Carl Reiner's case, it's absolutely true. He will be greatly missed. End quote. My heart goes out to Mel and to Carl's family. So without further ado, here's a conversation I had with this wonderful man in 2017. There will truly never be another Carl Reiner. I'm delighted to talk once more with comedy legend Carl Reiner. He starred alongside Sid Caesar on Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour, as well as in the Ocean's 11 films, many guest appearances on television, including his Emmy-winning guest role on Mad About You, and of course, the 2,000-Year-Old Man albums, which earned him and Mel Brooks a Grammy. He created, produced, and wrote for the beloved sitcom The Dick Van Dyke Show, which ran for 5 seasons, earning 9 of his 12 Emmy Awards. He's also a prolific writer-director whose credits include Oh God, Where's Papa, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, and some of Steve Martin's best movies, including The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me. At age 95, he hasn't slowed down yet. He has a new book called Too Busy to Die and a documentary about thriving in your 90s called If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast, which airs on HBO Monday, June 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Mr. Reiner, it's great to talk to you again.
And I'm so glad you told me the date because people ask me and I don't know. Now I know it's June what?
June 5th, Monday, I think. It's coming right up. Well, we talked a year ago about your book, When and Why the Dick Van Dyke Show was born, and you said you're feeling great, so count on coming back to talk about the next book the same time this year. Now here we are. You have a new book, very appropriately titled Too Busy to Die, and of course the documentary. You certainly haven't slowed down, have you?
Well, I'm slowing down, but not stopping.
Down but not out.
As a matter of fact, I got 2 more books coming out after this. Photo books, and they're so wonderful to look at. When you finish, you come upstairs and say, I'll show you what we're doing.
Yeah, what are those about?
Well, one of them is called The Movies I've Loved Since I'm 5 years Old. It's about movies I've seen. My first movie that I saw was Faust when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. And every movie I saw that informed who I became. Mm-hmm. All the movies I've seen, I have the posters of them and 4 little clips from them. And they're fascinating. It's like eating peanuts. You can't stop.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a new one, which is approaching 96. The pics I viewed, I love viewing and love doing. So It's all the pictures I've love seeing and the ones I've...
Okay. Yeah, done. You're a big movie buff, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
I heard that you and Mel Brooks watch movies practically every night together.
Yeah, that or just Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune. Can't miss those.
What kind of movies do you guys like to watch?
Well, we used to say any movie that... We used to love the Jason Bourne movies. We adored those. Any movie that has the phrase, secure the perimeter, get some sleep.
Well, your new book is a collection of anecdotes, short stories, opinions, and it also covers a lot more of your early years and your start in show business. I didn't realize this, but you wanted to be an opera singer when you were a kid, right? Not a comedian.
Yes. Well, my father, 2 things. I wanted to be an opera singer and also an Irish tenor. My father, who had a friend named Max Kalfas, a very dear friend, had a brother. And we used to listen to him every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock on WOR. He would come on and say, hello, this is John Calvin. Going to sing songs my mother sang to me when I was a wee lad. I love those songs, by the way. The first one I remember hearing is Tumble Down Shack in Athlone. Oh, I want to go back to that tumble down shack where the bright roses bloom round the door. Anyway, and I said to my father, I said, I'd like to want to be an Irish tenor. He says, you can be a Jewish tenor. But, and then my father had a lot of, classic records, violin records, but he loved Caruso, as everybody did. Mm-hmm. Maybe the greatest tenor who ever, ever, ever lived.
Yeah.
His recordings are done on non-orthographic, and so even on those, you can hear that he had reached heights that nobody ever reached. His notes were fuller. He was anyway. So I want to be an opera singer. The only problem is I sing off key and out of rhythm, and otherwise I would. I've got the voice, but
yeah.
I've improved a little.
So you were a Jewish New Yorker who wanted to be an Irish tenor.
Yes.
Okay. You know, having watched this documentary, it seems that you still like to sing a lot. That's one thing that I noticed, that all of the people that you talk to, like Dick Van Dyke, your buddy Mel Brooks, everyone who makes it into their 90s seems to sing a lot every day.
Yes,
you think that's part of the secret?
Yes. I sing in the morning when I get up. I'll test my voice to see if the operatic tenor is still there. Recitar mentre presso dal delirio. I start that way, and then I know I'm all right for the day.
Yeah, you're holding up pretty well, I think. Yeah, I think I read in the book that one of your first girlfriends, you sent her a bunch of Caruso records.
Yes, you know.
When she went home.
Yeah, she was from Oklahoma and didn't know about opera.
Did she like Caruso?
Well, she found out that it's worth listening to,
yeah.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember, you met her when you were doing summer stock, is that right?
Yes, she was an apprentice in the summer stock theater. She was the one who came up and said, I just love you. Because I did Basil Rathbone to The Devil Passes, and it was a very flamboyant role. And that became my girlfriend for the summer. When somebody... If she yells at, I love you, you say, okay, yeah. I guess I can like you back.
Well, I was interested to read that you got your first acting break through Roosevelt's Works Project Administration during the Depression.
The WPA, I keep telling people that those who say that, you know, get off the government's back, I said, that's what government's for, especially during hard times when people need work. And more people became... what they are, engineers, bridge builders, artists, painters, actors, because the government, in this case, free acting classes at 100 Center Street. It was a little ad my brother saw in the New York News. Huh. And I went down there, and this is Mrs. Whitmore taught a class for free of, actors and wannabe actors. And that was the beginning.
Yeah, because it's funny. I knew that the WPA built roads and post office, Tennessee Valley Authority, but I never knew that they created jobs for actors and writers and directors, too.
Oh, my God. Some of the most beautiful murals in post offices were done under the WPA for artists who were out of work.
Now, what did you do during the war? You were a telegrapher for a while, is that
right?
I
was in the message center. Not a telegrapher. I wasn't first. I did the Morse code. No, but then I became a message center.
Teletype?
No.
Okay.
Jesus, isn't that funny? That's what's happening lately. I lose words. I lose more than words, but it'll come back while we're talking.
Okay. Yeah. And at one point, you got... sort of drafted into their entertainment unit, right? How did that come about?
On my way to, which I didn't know was Iwo Jima, I was on a detachment and we're in Hawaii going someplace the following day. And I went to see a GI version of Hamlet that my friend Howie Morris, that I met during another WPA project, the NYA Radio Workshop, $22 a month. We got paid for the government for doing radio shows. Huh. And so again, the government came in. And Howie Morris, I went backstage and I said, Howie, you were great as Laertes. And he said, do you have an act? I said, I do actually, because in the Army you couldn't do Shakespeare. You couldn't do it. So I worked up an act. I had a comedy act. And I said, but I'm going someplace tomorrow. I can't. And my friend Saul Pomerantz, who was with me, said, why don't you? Maurice Evans was the head of the entertainment section, and Alan Ludden was his captain. And they said, why don't you work, do your act for them and see how good you are for professionals. I went down, and I really killed them. They said, but we'd like to have you with us. And I said, I can't. I'm going someplace tomorrow. I didn't know where at the time. This is very interesting. I trained with these guys for a year in the message, as a teletype operator.
Okay.
For a whole year I was with these guys, and they transferred me out, traded me like a ball player. And this is like a bad movie. 1 year later, I'm now entertaining the troops all over the Pacific, Saipan, Tinian, Guam, Palau, and Awitak, going all over for 1 year with a show that I wrote some sketches for and did a stand-up. And on VJ Day, this is like nobody could believe this, on VJ Day, we land in Iwo Jima, where all my buddies are. I have kept in touch with them, but I couldn't believe that there I was, the star of a show, playing for my old buddies who I hadn't, and we're celebrating the end of the war. It was like a, you know, nobody could believe that.
Do you ever think that if that hadn't happened, you might not be here?
Oh, of course. When I learned about Iwo Jima 4 days after it happened, nobody knew about it yet, the invasion of Iwo. But my friend Saul was sent a note back. A guy was being carried from the beach, a Marine who landed first. He was hurt, and I gave my friend put a note on his stomach. He said, "Would you mail us V-mail?"
Wow.
And I got a letter 4 days. He says that, and the letter said one thing. We were both atheists. He says, "There are atheists in foxholes." And he was in the foxhole when he wrote that letter.
Now, I read that when you were entertaining the troops, you did impressions. And actually, I guess throughout your career, you've done impressions.
Yeah, yes.
Who did you do?
At that time, I could do, I did Charles Boyer, I did Jimmy Stewart, Kim Temirov, Ronald Coleman.
Okay,
And I did, when I auditioned for Maurice Evans, I did Maurice Evans doing Shakespeare, spitting as he was. spit a lot as he talked.
Do you still do any impressions?
I can, but I don't.
Okay. Well, in your...
Well, like, I still can do
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, Stewart, I can still do.
Well, yeah, he lived not far from here. Was he kind of a neighbor of yours?
He was, but I didn't know him either.
Yeah. Well, in the book, you talk about confronting a racist sergeant when you were stationed at Camp Crowder, Missouri during the war.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was, I wrote it in first, I put it in this book, but I had it in another book called How Paul Robeson Saved My Life and Mother.
Another great opera star.
Many happy stories, yeah. What happened is there was a non-commissioned officer school for us that I was going to become a corporal, and we had to go to the school. That was in a barracks. And there was a black group there, and they didn't have a special place. So they lived in the same barracks. The only place where we cohabited with African Americans, they lived upstairs, we lived downstairs. But we had a common latrine. And one day in the latrine, I'm chatting with a black gentleman who was very, very bright. He was, you know, really college educated, had degrees, and we were talking about something very interesting to me. And he was expounding, and I'm asking him questions. And when I got back to my bunk, one of the racist Southerners said, "We seen you talking to that nigger." He called him a nigger.
Wow.
And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Why are you talking?" I said, "Well, he's a very bright man. I was having a wonderful conversation. Is you think a nigger can be as good as a white man?" I said, "Well, this I certainly." He says, "You name one that's as good as a white man." I'm not kidding. He said, "Name one." And on top of my head, I said, "Paul Robeson." And he said, "What'd he do?" I said, "Well, he was an All-American football player at Rutgers, and he speaks 5 languages. And he said, I could put myself up against any black." And I said, "Really?" And there were guys there. And I said, "We kept score." Yeah. I said, he spoke 6 languages. Or so he did, I think.
Wow.
6 languages. He said, "I speak American." I said, "Okay, one. I said, he graduated with honors from Rutgers. I never went to college, 2-2, and went on like
still
this,
a tie,
you know.
Huh?
Yeah, he was on Broadway. He did,
Showboat, right?
He played Shakespeare. No, he played the Moor. Who was? Othello.
Othello. Yeah.
I say he played Othello on Broadway. I never seen a play. 5-5, you know. He went on like this. At one point, he said, "I'm a graduate embalmer."
Embalmer? Like corpses, right?
Embalmer. I said, oh. I said, "This is not fair. You held this till the end." I said, "As far as I know, Robeson can't embalm." And I said, "Give him a finger. He wouldn't know how to embalm it. You win." Anyway, the guys were laughing. At night, we're in bed and was sleeping in top bunks. And And I hear this voice, Rana, with a lot of Y's in Rana. You a G U and more Y's in it. J-Y-Y-U. I said, I said, yes, why do you ask? Oh, first he said, you want to step outside with carbines. That's the first line. Want to step out? I said, why? He said, well, settle this. I said, no, we'll settle nothing. I said, I'm a track shot. We walk outside before your finger's on the trigger, you're dead. And I have to go to, I'm in jail for the rest of the, anyway.
Were you a good shot?
No.
No.
No, I'm just lying. Bluffed. I'm just lying.
Okay.
And everybody's laughing, you know.
Yeah.
And then got Ron, a huge you. That was the big one. I said, why do you ask? He says, in Texas where he lives, you know Goldfarb? I said, who? Alfred Goldfarb. He figured every Jew knew every Jew.
Every Jew knows each other.
He lives in Texas. And then he said, he's not a bad guy. That was it. I learned later that he ran for the Senate.
And why does that not surprise me?
Yeah, and I said at the very end, I didn't know whether it was the state senator or the nation. I didn't know to worry for his state or my nation.
These days he might win.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
Well, last time we talked about your show of shows and the most famous writer's room in TV history. I meant to ask you at the time, and I forgot. I once heard that the producer of your show of shows, Max Liebman, couldn't stand Mel Brooks. Is that true?
Well, Mel Brooks was obstreperous. He was noisy, and we all knew he was the funniest guy in the room. He didn't work for Max, but he worked for City.
Right.
He gave him jokes for $15, $20, $30, whatever. And when he finally did get on the payroll, Max started to pay him. He would come in late, and then when he'd come in, he'd slide across the room, and he was obstreperous, and he says, safe, you know, like he would fall on the floor. And Max finally accepted him.
Yeah.
He happened to be the funniest man around in the world.
Yeah, I heard that he used to throw lit cigars at Mel Brooks.
Yeah, he was... We all smoke cigars because Sid smoked them and Max smoked them. I never smoked cigars. And I said, well, if I'm going to get, I might as well give myself my own smoke rather than smoke theirs.
Now, I don't know if this is true, but didn't Mel Brooks claim that he based the character of Max Bialystock in the producers on Liebman's personality?
I think he did, although Max Liebman was a real good producer.
Right, very
and Bialystock successful. Was a fraud.
Yeah, schmuck.
Yeah, a fraud, yeah.
Well, you and Mel, of course, became famous for the 2,000-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that of all people, Cary Grant was a huge fan of the 2,000-year-old man.
Well, we weren't sure that this would go for all people because it was a Jewish-accented comedian. It was 4 years after the war,
mm-hmm.
and the Jewish accent, the Jews were maligned. So we did it only for friends at parties, and people would make parties, so we get to do it. And we did it in the office. And finally, we were talked into putting on a record. Steve Allen actually put it. He said, you got to put it on a record. Oh. And we did. And when we put it on a record, I was Universal at the time making movies. And Cary Grant had a bungalow next to mine. And one day he came by and I said, Cary, I got something I might be interested. I gave him an album. And he came back the next day. He says, I loved it. He says, can only have a dozen. I said, why? I'm going to England. I says, you take this to England with you? Yeah, they speak English there, he told me. He came back and says, she loved it. I said, who? He says, the Queen Mother. I played it at Buckingham Palace. And I told Mel, well, we're in. I said, the biggest chicks in the world love the album, so we're okay.
Well, in your book, you tell a story about you, Eva Marie Saint, Brian Keith, and Norman Jewison flying back up to Northern California to film The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. You had something of a close call, huh?
Well, we were sitting in a one engine plane, And there was it was a rainstorm, and we were flying very low. And at one point, I think it was Eve Marie, said, let's get a bus or so, go to back to New York, I mean, back to California. And he made a quick bank, and the little cargo door, a tiny little door, 4 or 5 inches wide, opened up at the back of the plane where Norman was sitting. We were sitting on two seats. He was sitting on a little jump seat behind us, a little seat that fell down from the, turned it down from the wall. And all of a sudden, I reached back, and I heard the whoosh, and I reached back, and I can't feel Norman. I reached behind me, and I said, uh-oh, we lost Norman. What had Norman had done is he had put his body outside the plane to get the handle of the door, to pull the door shut. So he was hanging outside.
Oh, my God.
And he put the door shut, and we realized we had Norman back.
And, of course, he's famous for directing and writing Fiddler on the Roof.
What a force of nature he was.
TV and film. Yeah, well, you know, I want to talk about this new HBO documentary of yours called If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast. Does that title sort of sum up your philosophy of life at this age?
The original thing, by the way, my nephew-in-law, George Shapiro, came up with this concept.
Right.
It was called Vital at 90, and he went all over the country finding out people who were over 90 and still active doing things. And I always said in the morning, the first thing I do is read the obits. If I'm not in it, I'll have breakfast. And I told him that, and he told somebody, he said, that's what the title should be. If you're not in the obit, eat breakfast. George Shapiro really conceived and got everybody together. He worked like a dog, and it's one of the best produced things you'll ever see. And it's because of George Shapiro.
Yeah, and apparently you had a little bit of a scare one day because you actually did open the obituary and you did see your picture in there, right?
I know. I did. And there I was in a tuxedo looking very good, standing next to Polly Bergen, who had passed away. And I said, oh, my, I was sorry to see she went. I worked with her a few times, but I thought to myself, Polly Bergen had a lot of wonderful people in her life. She had good affairs, you know, married. Mm-hmm. I said, why did they pick a picture? Couldn't they pick a picture of somebody in her family instead of with me?
Or a headshot?
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Well, what do you think are the most important keys to longevity and thriving in old age? You seem to have it figured out.
Have a reason to get up. Right now, upstairs, I'm doing two new photographic books. And I can't wait to get up and have my graphic editor putting together. It's just thrilling. And this book, Too Busy to Die, came about because I finished the book and I didn't know what to do. But it's always and now, after I finish these two books, there's two of them, as a matter of fact, one going from when I was 5 years old to Army and the other one going to right now to what picture I might see tomorrow. And I'm saying, what do I do now? And I think I have an idea for something, but I won't say it. No, because it may not work out.
Well, what is your daily routine like? Walk us through that.
Oh, well, right now, I see it as you get older. I used to walk around a block, and then I walked halfway around a block. Now I get on the treadmill for 10 minutes. Not a treadmill, a stationary bike for 10 minutes.
Wow.
That's about it for the... And I walk about up and down stairs, and I mainly stay in the house, and I don't go out to lunch and dinner anymore. Mm-hmm. People come here. If I have to go out, I did something that I was thrilled to do a couple months ago. I did Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, and there's a new one coming out with Sandra Bullock is doing with women.
Oh, really?
And she asked me to do a scene with her. It was just a few-minute scene, but I went out and I was able to tell her that she is my favorite actress. I just love her. There's nothing she can do that I don't find. When she did The Net, and that one first movie I saw, and my God, her and a computer just telling you everything. Her face lit up the screen, and you knew what she was thinking.
Wow, so you're still acting. That's great.
That was a little bit I did there.
Hey, it's better than nothing.
Yes, and I was able to tell her how I felt about her performance in the movie she made about with getting married. What is it called?
Proposal. Oh, okay. The proposal. There we go. Yeah, I knew you were going to think of it faster than I would.
That was such a delightful movie.
Mm. Well, I once heard some experts say that the key to reaching 100 years old is resilience and your ability to cope with loss and tragedy. You know, when you get to the age where you never know when you're going to find a friend of yours in the obituary that morning, how do you handle that?
Well, when I read the obits now, I look at the age and I'll say, look at the date they were born. Mm-hmm. And I say, got you beat. Oh, you beat me, Mainly I got them beat. Yeah, no. People don't seem to be going at 80, 83, 85, mm-hmm. 89. Once in a while, you get in Georgie's thing, he's got a 100-year-old marathon runner.
Yeah. I wonder, when you do see people that you know pass away, like Polly Bergen in their 80s, do you ever think to yourself, what did they do differently than I did? How come I'm here and they're not?
No, I always wonder how I'm going to go. I don't know.
Oh, really?
I would love to, you know, go to sleep and not wake up, but it's not easy. The other day I was thinking, maybe this is it, because my pulse was very low. I take my pulse, my blood pressure with a cuff. Here it is, the one right here. and I didn't take it today, but I'll see what was on yesterday. And yesterday, 129 over 75. And that's what it usually is.
Not bad.
But one day it was for some reason lower than ever. And I said, this is it. Maybe that's just slip out under the door.
Well, one person in the documentary says that one of the keys to longevity is to have a lot of face-to-face interaction with another human being. They say 5 to 6 hours during their day. You hang out with your best friend Mel Brooks almost every evening. Do you think that those hours spent together have extended both of your lives?
I'm sure it has. Yes, if you have no reason to get up, you won't get up. And he's been sick for a week or two, and he hasn't been here. He went to New York and did a lot of performances, which he packs stadiums with people to talk, to make fun with. He shows his Blazing Saddles, and he really wrecks them. And he hasn't been here for a week, and it's sort of lonely, but I have this thing going upstairs that keeps me going. Yeah.
Now, have the two of you ever thought about writing a book together about your friendship?
No, never thought about that.
Or friendship in general?
He's in this new book. You'll see there's photos of every picture that I've ever loved, and there's a number of his in it.
Well, you know, I have to think that there's no greater expert on longevity than the 2,000-year-old man. Have you ever asked him what the 2,000-year-old man would say is
never
the key?
Never touch fried old foods. Age?
Never touch fried foods, huh?
Never run for a bus.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a bunch. Every time I ask him that question, he gives me a different answer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I follow you on Twitter, and I don't think a day passes when you don't have something to say about Donald Trump. So I fear that I'd be shortchanging you if I didn't at least give you a minute here before we wrap up to vent about the new president.
Well, you know, I think he's his own weight is pulling him down now. So many people are going to be testifying very soon, next week, 6 days or something. It's unbelievable. The amount of things he's gone doing outside of the presidency is going to be found out. I mean, he's got deals with people all over the world, and they'll all be found out. He is the sleazy. I cannot believe. There was somebody made Alan Alda's grandson made a movie, a little movie, the best thing I've ever seen. I wake up every morning, and the first thing I turn on and think, see what Trump is up to. And so the story of this movie is the kid wakes up, or the young man wakes up, and the first thing he goes is, he starts to scream. He goes about his business, but he keeps screaming. He brushes his teeth, he washes, he goes to the toilet, but he screams. He goes out, he drives his car, he waves people across the street, still screaming, they're screaming. He meets a girl at a woman at a supermarket, they're all screaming. And that is what everybody's doing. Every 38% of the people, 38% approval rating now. And I really feel sorry for the people who voted for him. And now he's going to drop Meals on Wheels, and he's going to take the minimum wage down. Yeah. I can't believe what he's doing it all in the name of billion. All for the amount of billions he's going to be able to get from the lowering of the taxes. It'll lower very few taxes at the bottom. You can't, and it's told people to talk about it, but nothing seems to happen. He's still there.
Well, you know, you're someone who firsthand experienced McCarthyism and had a number of friends who were right. victims of the blacklist.
Right, right.
Looking back at that and these people who were wrongfully persecuted for their political beliefs, does it shock you to now look and see that here we have a guy who seems to have frighteningly suspicious connections to Russia, and he's occupying the White House?
I know. No, there's no doubt that he's everybody knew that he had something going on. And Hillary Clinton, who I thought would be our president, and who got 3 million more votes than he did, mm-hmm. and we have this antiquated electoral college, which was put in place for people who, in little communities, who couldn't read or write, so right. they had an electoral college. That should be done away with. We would have had a woman who was the Secretary of State who. One of the brightest people, if you ever saw her documentary, you realize that yeah. at 16, she was working for children on her own. She took it up upon herself to help poor kids that, you know, needed reading, writing, or food. She's an extraordinary woman. And that's one of the saddest things, that she didn't get to be the president.
Well, before...
Lock her up, he said. And now he should be locked up.
We shall see. Well, before we go, when you came down at first, you told me that you figured out the meaning of covfefe. What did you find
out?
Yes,
well, you know, he tweeted something, C-O-V-F-E-F-E, covfefe, covfefe. Yeah. And I said, what does that mean? And I said, well, maybe. Ah, then I realized he might have gone one letter down from the original word, which uh-huh. the original word is Benuded, B-N-U-E-D-E-D. If you go one letter yeah. up, so he wants to say benuded. He's benuding the world, the country. He's taking clothes and food out of people's eyes. Benuding us. It should be denuded, but he doesn't even know that.
Well, you figured it out.
I would like to say one thing about the book that is, you'll never see any Please. Place else in the world. I have written here a story, a love story, and it has the longest title of any. It's a full-page title, but the story is in the largest font ever seen in a literary work. The font allows only for 5 words on a line and 12, 10 lines on a page, and it's a really beautiful love story, yeah. and never been done. The largest font ever used.
Okay. Is this a nod to 90-year-olds, or what was the intention with that?
Well, the other thing that I might even read it to you, if you
okay,
it's
absolutely.
The end of the book, which is, you know, as I said, I'm an atheist, but I did say something here. There are 15 things about the Almighty that are never mentioned anywhere. I personally know that. He has a chronic back condition. His knee joints ache. He's allergic to shellfish and mustard. His prostate is moderately enlarged. He often sings off key. He hates wars but can't think of a way to stop them. He loves to check out a woman's legs as she passes by. He is upset by the unfair distribution of wealth. He loves to laugh. He gets goosebumps when a tenor hits a high C. He hates that comedies never win Oscars. He loves sushi, especially unagi. He hates talking to anyone wearing a tongue ring. He would like to replace the Ten Commandments with one commandment that covers everything. Thou shalt not hurt anybody. How do I know these things about God? I am man, and I was told that he created me in his image. And there's what he looks like.
Is that
it's
you?
Actually
that
picture
a young
me
Carl Reiner with the
picture
mustache.
Picture me at 20. And everybody who wants to know what God looks like, just yeah. put your put what you feel and about and what you don't like and do like, and put your picture there.
Look in the mirror.
That's what God looks like. Looks like you.
And on the front of the book, you have this terrific bow tie. I almost wore a bow tie today just for you, because you say that actors can tie bow ties, but directors can't.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, that's Mel and I were watching The Scoundrel with an old coward. He was tying, a tie. And he said, look how adept he is at that while he's talking. I said, every actor can do that. When I was a kid, I got my first tuxedo to play on stage. And so I was telling him that at a Directors Guild, I did 25 years of Directors Guild award dinners, emceeing. And I said, one day I was standing next to David Heller, who was our president. And I said, you wearing a clip-on? He says, yeah. And I says, that's the difference between directors and actors. And I opened my tie and I said, I'm wearing. And I said, how many directors are wearing? And everybody raised their hand.
Yeah.
And I started talking about the fact that actors, when they're young, they have to learn. They're wearing clip-ons in those days. And all of a sudden, I got a big hand. And I didn't realize what it was for. It was for that while I was talking, I tied my tie again without a mirror.
Now, what is the secret to keeping it straight? Because I can tie it, but it's always
crooked.
It's
exactly like a shoelace. Mm-hmm. Keep adjusting it. Just keep adjusting it till it's... Until it's absolutely straight, and you'll be able to do it.
Well, where can people order Too Busy to Die? And I think that you'll even sign it for people, right?
I will. I'll personalize it. If you check randomcontent.com,
okay.
Go to one of those purveyors of...
Terrific.
I'll be very happy to personalize it.
Great gift.
It sure
Wonderful.
Is.
Well, yeah, and the documentary, If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast, airs on HBO on June 5th, Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern. Mr. Reiner, thanks so much.
Thank
I appreciate
you
talking to me.
Now come upstairs and see what we're doing.
Okay.
And that was my pal, the great Carl Reiner. Man, how he made us laugh, and man, how he will certainly be missed. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.